Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Over the past 2.5 years, today's guests, siblings and filmmakers Ivy and Ivan McDonald, have developed intimate relationships with people and communities deeply affected by the epidemic of missing and murdered Indigenous women. And they have direct experience with this crisis in their own family. Their cousin, Monica Still Smoking, was taken from their family in 1979. In a piece about Monica for High Country News, Ivan McDonald writes, quote, "We heard stories about her growing up, as family members shared memories here and there, but as children, we knew there was more to the story. Our parents, trying to protect us from the grim truth, would often just share that she had two different colored eyes, one green and one brown. In this way, our family shared a collective memory that carried her spirit. Storytelling kept her alive," end quote. Well, 4 decades later, Ivan and Ivy are highlighting the stories of other families affected by this epidemic in Montana, where Indigenous women and girls make up less than 4% of the population, but account for 30% of those deemed missing by the state's Department of Justice. In one story in the documentary, When They Were Here, they focus on Bonnie Three Irons. She went missing near the Wolf Mountains on the Crow Reservation in 2017. After struggling to file a missing persons report with the local tribal police, her family organized a search party of their own, finding Bonnie's body in just 3 hours. No one's been charged, and the, quote, open investigation appears non-existent. Bonnie's mother, Jennifer, continues to struggle to come to terms with the loss of her daughter and the injustice that comes with investigating crime in Indian country. And just last month, the body of 16-year-old Crow Tribe citizen Selena Not Afraid was found a mile from the Montana rest stop where she was last seen on New Year's Day. According to The Independent, in 2017 alone, 5,646 Native women were reported missing in the United States. Ivy and Ivan McDonald join us to talk about this crisis and their new film, When They Were Here. Ivan has a master's in social work and has spent years working with Indigenous communities in a variety of settings, including prisons and activist spaces. Ivy graduated from the University of Montana in 2017 with a BFA in digital filmmaking. They are enrolled members of the Blackfeet Tribe of Northern Montana. And if you are in the Bay Area, they will be speaking tonight at UC Berkeley at 6 p.m. And let me just grab the information here. It's a free event. Again, 6 p.m. at UC Berkeley, and it'll be at the MCC, 2495 Bancroft Way, and we'll get more information throughout the show. Ivy and Ivan McDonald join us in studio. Hi, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much for having us.
It's great to have you. So it's your first time to the Bay Area?
Yep, first time.
Welcome. Before the show, we were talking about all the rich Native history in this area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and even some of the family history that we have here. Our mom lived here for a blip in the 60s, and our great uncle went to Berkeley and was involved in a lot of the AIM stuff around the time in the 60s.
That's great. Will you have time to go to Alcatraz?
Probably the end of the month, actually.
Yeah, we have a second trip back at the end of the month, and hopefully going to do some more of the touristy stuff.
That's great, because they have a special exhibit there on the occupation of Alcatraz that I still need to see, but I hope you can make it there.
Yeah, I've definitely been talking about it.
So. Yeah, that's great. So you have a personal story around this, and your documentary is a work in progress, and I watched the clip, and it's really powerful. Why did you decide to make a film about this issue?
It was actually in one of the final semesters when I was obtaining my master's in social work at the University of Montana, and there was a project we were tasked with taking a very broad, maybe hard to understand without proper context issue currently. I come from a research background, so I was like, oh, I'll maybe do some research, author a journal article, have it submitted, hopefully get it published. But as I slowly started doing more research, I was like, the people who need to see this information aren't going to get it from an academic journal. It was tribal communities, our fellow Indigenous people in Missoula. And Ivy was wrapping up her final semester in her BFA. And I approached her and I was like, hey, do you think we could turn this into like a short documentary, and kind of went from there. We got a really small grant from the university, and I think filmed over 3 weekends within a month. Ivy edited it, and it was like a rough, really kind of rough 20-minute clip that we just kind of threw together and kind of started the work.
Yeah, it was like 22-minute short film, and like I even said, it was just bare bones, just us doing it. I had a friend who did sound for it, and just, yeah, it was very very student-led, but it created an impact, and this is why we're here now.
What has the experience been like for you? Because over the last 2.5 years, you have really gotten to know families and community members that are directly affected by this, and over that time, finally, thanks to Indigenous activists, there are so many more stories in the national media about missing and murdered Indigenous women. What's that been like, Ivy, to see the change happen?
It's been incredible. Like, over the past 2.5 years, just, you know, like you said, it's because of Indigenous activists. You know, we have a lot of incredible, amazing friends and colleagues that we work with in Montana who all just work in this crisis. And, like, you know, we have a really good friend named Marita Growing Thunder who she, for the past 3 years, has been doing a walk across the Flathead Reservation, which is 90 miles long. And last year I was able to participate all 4 days, and it was just walking to raise awareness. And we have, but the crisis, you know, in the last 2 years is becoming, it's finally being heard. And it's because of all the hard work that all of the Indigenous activists are doing, and it's about time.
Right. In a lot of the climate marches, for example, there are a lot of people in red holding these beautiful signs to raise awareness about missing and murdered Indigenous women. On social media, it's hashtag MMIW. And then, Ivan, the families have also done incredible work trying to raise awareness about how broken the system is and how they have to really take these matters into their own hands.
Yeah, I mean, there's historical context for that. So when our cousin went missing in 1979, even our aunt and uncle kind of struggled to file a police report. Monica was 7 when she went missing, and this was in the dead of winter. And I remember my uncle saying, you know, the police had told him, oh, you know, she's with friends, she'll come back. And it was about 3 days later where it kind of became serious, where they're like, okay, we have to start searching. You know, this was a 7-year-old in the middle of winter. And yeah, our uncle, friends, family began searching. And it was actually another uncle of Monica, I think from her mom's side, who actually ended up finding her body frozen to a mountain. Mm. And the FBI investigated for 2 weeks on the reservation. From what my uncle said, he never heard from them again when they left, but they would reach out to our aunt, Monica's mother, periodically and be like, oh, we may have some new evidence, we're going to exhume her body, but then nothing ever really came from that.
Wow. And she was just 7. Mm-hmm. What do you remember about the stories you were told about your cousin when you were young?
I think there's always kind of been this sort of specter of memory there that's kind of hung over. I remember whenever we would drive kind of where the area or the mountain that she was found, I remember one time just very distinctly my dad being, that's where they found your cousin Monica. And it was just like, we were children, and we used to go through drives because it was really near Glacier National Park. Mm-hmm. Used to do drives, and, you know, there was always sort of this specter of, you know, don't run off on your own, or, you know, be very aware of your surroundings. It was sort of that history that kind of informed some of our family. And like was brought up earlier, you know, we were always told that, you know, she had one blue eye, one gray eye, different colored eyes. And there was just sort of this magnetism to her, even as a child. And yeah, I think just kind of growing up, you know, we're very aware we didn't know Monica. But I think it was through that memory and hearing that from our other family that there's obviously that connection there.
Ivy, how did your family respond when you told them you were making this film?
Actually, our dad, when we were searching for people to interview or sort of, you know, like the families, my dad brought it up and he was like, have you thought about interviewing your Uncle Kenny about Monica? And then we ended up, you know, being like, oh, that, you know, that's something we can do. And so we ended up getting in contact with our uncle. And it was actually with our uncle, it was the first time he ever talked about her in 40 years. And, you know, through that, it's been really healing, you know, and especially with him, he talks about how talking about her keeps her memory alive. And, you know, I distinctly remember this summer we did a march in Browning led by an incredible woman named Kimberly Loring Heavy Runner. She's our relative, and she's her sister Ashley is actually one of the stories in our film. But it was our Uncle Kenny. I remember just looking, and he had a picture of he was walking in the march, and he had a picture of Monica, and he was holding it over his head, and just like going from 2 years ago from him not talking about her to for 40 years to him marching in a awareness march for missing and murdered Indigenous women and people, and just seeing that just was incredible.
Yeah, I also think that's kind of the power of this storytelling as justice in some way for Indigenous communities. We're very aware that we may not get justice in the legal sense, but I remember from our initial work with our uncle in that short that we did, our uncle did, after our work and people learned about it, the Associated Press reached out to us about interviewing our uncle. And I remember we did this huge article. It was all over national news. And I remember the first time seeing a picture of my uncle standing over the grave of Monica. And I was like, you know, this is a story that was in our family for 40 years. And it sort of took one opportunity to share it where, you know, there was a chance for people across the United States to learn about it.
Mm. That's really powerful. I mean, for your uncle to share this story and then for all of your relatives to see that for the first time after, you know, just knowing that he hasn't talked about it in 40 years. Mm-hmm. Have you found other families like that or other people who have a hard time talking about it? I mean, every story is very different. Some people are right there and they want to be, let's get the media coverage, mm-hmm. and other people, you know,
yeah,
don't.
I do think there is some context of time. I think it's the families who've, whether it's 40, 50, we interviewed a family that lived in the Confederated Salish Kootenai Tribes Reservation in the Flathead area of Montana.
In Arlee.
Yeah, in Arlee. And, you know, their grandmother was found dead behind a bar, covered in bruises. There was some evidence that gasoline was inside of her stomach.
Mm.
And this was in 1959, and the family, until we had interviewed that family, it was something that they had carried forward with them for the 59, 60 years. And, you know, I think that at that point with these families, they share it not in the sense of, let's get the media here, let's try to get some sort of justice. I think that they really share these stories in just an instance of, you know, this person was alive here at one time, and, you know, due to whatever barriers of justice there are for Indigenous and marginalized groups, they didn't have the justice, but her memory is kept alive. This specific family talked a lot about how they learned the songs that their grandma used to sing. She was a very well-known traditional singer, and you know, they keep that memory alive through the songs and what they learned through that, and that's sort of how they keep her memory going forward.
It's shocking to read about the statistics in Montana, where the population of Indigenous women is less than 4%, but Indigenous women and girls account for 30% of those deemed missing. Now, this is an official number by the state's Department of Justice. Mm-hmm. And then other stories have numbers from, say, 2017 in The Independent, 5,646. What have you run across in terms of data? And what did the activists say that those are low numbers because there's no official database?
Yeah. So the number actually in Montana fluctuates a lot. But overall, indigenous. So I usually go into the Montana Missing Persons Clearinghouse under the Department of Justice, usually twice a month, and sort of calculate numbers. And it always seems to hover around that 25-30% of, you know, not just indigenous women, but indigenous people in general. They're very vastly overrepresented in those statistics. We work a lot with Anita Lucchesi, who runs the Sovereign Bodies Institute. She's actually in Eureka. We're actually going to film with her tomorrow. We're heading to Eureka after our presentation. And she probably runs maybe the most comprehensive database dedicated to collecting stats around missing and murdered Indigenous women. And I remember when I first made contact with her and learned about her work, it was just sort of something she was doing in her bedroom, in her house, at her kitchen table. And, you know, just sort of the data that she's collecting, there's some numbers that the Department of Justice didn't have, or cases that they hadn't tracked as murder. And I think what really kind of sets her data apart from other people is that she works with the family. She collects these stories. She collects them from the community. And it's really through her sheer force, sheer will, that, you know, this crisis is finally being counted in a way that is meaningful to the people who, you know, have to deal with it.
What have you learned, Ivy? Would you say that this is a growing crisis?
I mean, I wouldn't say growing. I would say that it's nothing new. You know, it's been going on since colonization. And right. So I think it's just kind of, because of the awareness and because of all of the work, it's becoming more apparent that there is something going on and there's something not right. And, you know, even with all the numbers, all the stats, like, because people are paying attention, it's just that number is just, when you say it like that, it's like, oh, wow, mm-hmm. you know, but it's nothing new at all.
And right. I find that, like, when people, you know, particularly when Indigenous girls and women and even men go missing in Montana, the immediate response is from the Indigenous people there. Like, I see flyers, missing persons posters all the time on our social media. We have them sent to us. And I think that finally, I'm thinking of the case of Selena Not Afraid, where, you know, her story was on the cover of New York Times front page, where people are finally paying attention to what communities have been saying for years, that, you know, our loved ones are going missing, they're being murdered, but we're not getting justice. And I think that those numbers kind of reflect that, of people finally paying attention. Because the numbers have largely, I think the numbers are largely underreported. But I think that now that there's kind of this movement and time to really hopefully start tracking this crisis as it's happening.
And I think too, putting, like Ivan said, with the flyers and that, putting faces to the numbers.
Right.
You see that all the time on our face, like Facebook, you see missing people posters, but actually putting faces to the numbers. And I think real people realizing, like, you know, these aren't just numbers and stats. These are people that are going missing and have been missing.
And men are also missing, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. I mean, it's majority women, but men are also missing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, even, you know, I think it's just across the board, the violence that Indigenous people face. Like, we had made a mention that our uncle, our great uncle, had attended school in Berkeley and was like a semester away from graduating. And was part of, you know, the AIM movement that had happened in this area, but ended up dying in the back of a police car. Somehow he had his hands handcuffed behind him, but the police said he slit his own throat. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that's kind of just, I think, just across the board, the communities that are largely affected by this crisis, it's often on their own. They deal with it on their own. And I think that's kind of a thread in the film of, you know, we may not get justice in the legal sense, but it's justice in telling our stories, but it's just the resiliency of indigenous people to try to make it through and, you know, just come out on the other side any way you can.
Today, we're joined by Ivan and Ivy McDonald. They are siblings and filmmakers working on a new documentary. And you can actually see a clip from the documentary at yourcallradio.org. It's called When They Were Here. And if you're in the Bay Area, they'll be speaking tonight at UC Berkeley at 6 o'clock. Do you know what MCC stands for?
I think it's the Multicultural Center.
Perfect. Thank you. That may be okay. Multicultural Center. And it is at 2495 Bancroft Way, and it is a free event. Find more information online at yourcallradio.org. I have to ask both of you, since you're talking about Montana and you brought up Browning, I took a road trip in 2005, and I was going to Browning to interview Native people about just a wide range of issues. And on my way there, I'll never forget this, a group of white men at a gas station said, "Where are you headed?" And I said, "Browning." They said, "Browning? Why are you going to Browning?" I said, "Well, I'm going to interview Native people." They said, "Don't go to Browning. It's dangerous. Get ready. You might get in a fight." And I thought, what? I mean, and if you've never been to Montana, Browning is at the foot of Glacier National Park.
Yes.
So a lot of people drive through there to go on their national park trip. I'll never forget that. Can you just talk about the racism that is experienced in Montana against Native peoples?
Yeah, I mean, I remember when I was, we had lived in Billings, which is on the eastern part of the state, and when I moved back to Missoula for grad school, I would tell people, you know, I'm Blackfeet, I'm from Browning, and of course, you know, non-Indigenous people know, we just have that connection. But I remember a lot of non-Native people would be like, "Oh my God, I've heard that place is like dangerous. I heard you could get stabbed in broad daylight or mugged," or, and I always share a story of, I remember someone had told me, you know, like, "Oh yeah, I remember I was told that when I first moved here." And then I was going up to Glacier National Park, and I ended up getting a flat tire in Browning, and I was very scared. I locked my doors. I didn't know what to do. And someone eventually came up to my car and knocked on the window. And of course I was scared, and they're like, "Oh, hey, is there something wrong? Like, we saw you sitting there for a while." And they said they had a flat, and this person ended up helping them get their car to a place where it could get fixed, and they were able to make on their way. And, you know, I think that kind of shifted that person's understanding of, you know, really how Browning is as a community. You know, we're from Browning. I love Browning. But Browning, like many reservations, so our reservation is the size of Delaware. And the community of Browning is about 1,500 people, kind of smack dab. We have smaller little other communities that are part of the reservation, but we're bordered by a lot of non-Indigenous communities. And I remember, you know, growing up being told, you know, "Don't wander off," or a big thing is sports with our community. So when we would go to different communities to play sports, you know, we would always get the prairie N-word or squaw. And I think often, not just with Browning, but a lot of other Indigenous communities that sort of border these areas, you know, there is a lot of profound racism that exists, but there's also this twofold of a lot of these communities rely on the business from tribal people, and there's this really like weird dynamic of a really symbiotic relationship that can happen where, you know, they may not like the fact that Natives come in to their communities, but Natives can often be drivers of their economy, so that there's a lot of this sort of experience that happens of just learning to live with it. Like, "Oh, I'm gonna go to Cut Bank or Great Falls. I know racist incident will happen, but I need to get groceries." And just kind of living with that experience of it, just kind of, I think you almost kind of get desensitized to it unless it's like a very abrasive attack, but, you know, just kind of dealing with it.
What would you add, Ivy?
Yeah, I think that's the thing. I think it comes down to just uneducated racist people, like, you know, that can happen anywhere, anytime, but because it's a reservation, because it's with Native Americans, it's centerfold with that. Like, I worked at a grocery store in Missoula where we're currently living, and, you know, people always ask, like, "What are you? What kind of Native are you?" You know, like, I get questions like that. And I had some women just ask me, like, you know, "What kind of Native are you?" And I told her Blackfeet. And she's like, "Where are you from?" And I said Browning. And her first response was like, "Oh, I'm sorry." And I just looked at her and I was like, "Sorry for what?" And she's like, "Well," she's like, "I've heard about Browning." And she's like, "I know nothing good comes from there." And I to be standing in front of someone who is blatantly saying that directly to you, knowing you're from Browning, knowing that that's where our family's from, our people are from, and saying nothing good comes from there. I just, yeah. And
this is like an area where our people have existed for tens of thousands of years. And,
yeah.
You know, that's our homeland.
It just speaks to, there's just so many layers. People are uneducated. The true history of this country is still whitewashed. We just talked mm-hmm. about Trump's State of the Union address where he said, you know, westward expansion, we're taming the wild. I mean, he's saying this in 2020. Then again, it's Trump who has a photo of Andrew Jackson on his wall in his office, a painting, I should say. And in Montana, I mean, there's such a, I mean, in every place, but Montana, there's so much rich native history mm-hmm. in Montana.
And Montana is like one of only, I think, two states where the second largest ethnic group, aside from white, is indigenous. So there's
right.
a lot more of this. There's so many layers and context to that, where I think Alaska might be the only other place with that sort of demographic. And, you know, it is very, the state is very divided down that of, okay, you have all of these reservations and then all the places off of reservations. And it's kind of seen as that. I mean, even when people are like, oh, I'm from this little community back east. And I'm like, okay, well, like, where is that? By Fort Peck? Is that by Fort Belknap? And that's kind of just my understanding of sort of that area or how understanding of Montana.
Today we are joined by Ivan and Ivy McDonald. They are siblings and filmmakers, and they've got a documentary in progress called When They Were Here. It is about the epidemic of murdered and missing Indigenous women and girls. And if you're in the area, they will be speaking tonight at UC Berkeley at the Multicultural Center at 6 o'clock. It's a free event. That's 2495 Bancroft Way. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
You're listening to Your Call on KALW Local Public Radio. To take part in today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. Let us know if you're a first-time caller. We always like to hear from new voices. And if you'd prefer to write rather than call, you can email yourcall@kalw.org or leave a comment on the website at yourcallradio.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. Coming up at 11, maybe you've never used TikTok, but the app is touching your life in ways you might not expect. National security threat or meme factory? Maybe TikTok is both. Learn more on 1A coming up at 11.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our media roundtable. We will discuss coverage of the State of the Union address, how have the media reacted to Donald Trump's claims about the state of the economy, the impact of his tax cuts for the wealthy and corporation, and his racist and xenophobic policies. We'll also talk about the Senate Republicans' decision to acquit Trump on articles of impeachment. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can send us an email, yourcall@kalw.org. And if you'd like to join today's conversation about the epidemic of missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls, we'd love to hear from you. This is getting so much more attention now thanks to Indigenous activists and families that have been directly affected by this. I feel like now there's a story on a regular basis in The Guardian, The New York Times. There's videos about this. Well, today's guests, Ivy and Ivan McDonald, are working on a film about this called When They Were Here. They are siblings and filmmakers. And if you have any questions or comments for them, if you've worked on this issue or you have direct experience, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. You can tweet us at yourcallradio. So you're specifically focusing on women and girls in Montana, where they make up less than 4% of the population but account for 30% of those deemed missing, and this is the official number. How are you going about finding the families, connecting with them, and then gaining their trust to basically allow you to tell their stories on film. Ivy, how are you going about that?
I think with us, I think because we've been doing this for 2.5 years, I think the way we meet the families and how we interact with them is very deliberate and very important as like filmmakers. You know, we don't just go into communities and extract stories. You know, we are doing legislation to get bills passed. We work on stuff other than just doing a film, getting it out and doing all that. We're actually actively trying to combat this crisis any way we can, which is, you know, by doing walks, raising awareness. And I think with the families, because we have family history with missing, like with the crisis and all of that, I think even though our stories aren't the same, we all know what we're going through. And, you know, especially with Indigenous people, it seems like everyone has someone in their family who was either missing or has been murdered. And so we, you know, I think as a filmmaker, especially with me, I try and go in and, you know, just let the families do what they need to and have them talk to us. And I think creating that space of them knowing that this isn't just going in, telling them, you know, do this, talk about this, but just letting them talk. And I think that has given us a way to reach everyone and just kind of like know that we're doing this because, you know, we need to raise awareness.
Yeah, we really stress that importance of connection. So beyond just filming with his families, we do a lot of work around them. So we've most recently, even though Selena's not a part of our film, I helped organize a vigil in Missoula to raise money for her family. Her family had a GoFundMe trying to raise money to help cover the funeral. Mm-hmm. And I think that our work, I think it's the opposite of our documentary led to this work, and it was more our work led to this documentary. And, you know, we just did a search for Jermaine Charlo, who went missing. She's from the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribe. She went missing July of 2018. Mm. And her family had a search this past Sunday, and we were a part of that. And I think it's like that, you know, as much as we're doing this filming work, we try to show up any way we can and support these families. And we're connected to these families through our community connections. I remember when I first got put in contact with Jennifer, I was actually a person from the Crow Reservation. We were the only two natives in a cohort of our master's program of 35. And she was like, you know, this is a woman who just lost her daughter, her family struggling to find answers. Would you be willing to share her story? And I ended up contacting Jennifer on the phone. And just, I was like, this is a story that needs to be told. And, you know, we ended up filming with her a little bit later that year, and have had a continued connection to her and her family.
Can you talk about what happens after someone goes missing? I read about in the intro, one of the stories you tell, Bonnie Three Irons, who went missing near the Wolf Mountains on the Crow Reservation in 2017. The family struggled to even file a missing persons report with the local tribal police. Is that common, and why does that happen?
I do think there is some issues on filing missing persons reports just in general. I think there's this misunderstanding that there needs to be this passage of time before you can file them. But I know that in Montana there is sort of no stipulations to that. There was a law that was passed, a state law passed last legislative session called Hannah's Act, and that was named after Hannah Harris, who went missing on the Northern Cheyenne Reservation in the community of Lame Deer. Her family kind of struggled to file a missing persons report as well. She was found dead three days later, murdered, and that law, the big impetus of that law was to sort of understand, why are these missing persons reports so hard to file? Oftentimes, people don't know, because of the jurisdictional issues, people don't know, okay, do I file the missing persons report with tribal, state, you know, highway patrol. And so the purpose of HANA's Act was to kind of create the system of the kind of the first agency that takes the missing persons report has to follow it until it gets to the proper channels. And that was due to this one mother who went missing. And I think that that's sort of the impact of these stories, of that one that can kind of elicit this hopefully positive change in the state.
So that's at the, I guess, local level, you could say. And then you've got Ashley Loring Heavy Runner, who went missing on the Blackfeet Reservation, northern Montana, in 2017. Her sister Kimberly has spent countless hours searching for any evidence on the reservation, as you said, the size of Delaware. It took 10 months for the FBI to finally begin investigating her case?
So it's a sort of a twofold process of the jurisdiction issues, where a lot of the times the BIA is sort of the federal agency that will take over investigation, and the FBI, who of course has more resources to sort of do these investigations, is only brought in when they're asked. So it was after the BIA finally asking the FBI, that was my understanding, to get involved, that the investigation finally had that full capacity to begin. But, you know, that's 10 months later. There was a lot of this evidence. Ashley's sister, Kimberly, actually testified in Washington, D.C. with Senator Tester, not this winter, the winter before. Mm-hmm. We're like, you know, the BIA police, you know, they lost a sweater. That was evidence. That was the last sweater that eyewitness had said Ashley had seen. And when Kimberly testified, the BIA was able to locate that sweater 3 hours later. They're like, oh, we have it. Like,
wow.
And that's just sort of some of these issues that come with these investigations. And it's just sort of the continuous struggle.
And I think also, too, a lot of the times when families either report their family member going missing, there's always this thing of, oh, well, she's of age, she can leave, or she's a party girl and she'll be back, she's just on a binge. And that's dangerous in itself, of being, that's how people respond to it when you're trying to tell them, like, no, I know something's wrong, my daughter's missing, my mom's missing, you know, like, and that's the response that happens. And like, we hear that all the time with families, and, you know, even with Jennifer White Bear, with Bonnie's story, it was the same thing. Oh, you know, she's a party girl, she'll be back. And with even with Monica, who was a 7-year-old girl, it's like, oh, she's with a friend, she'll be back, you know. So it happens all the time.
So they go after their character, just like when black men are shot and killed by police. The media, whoever, they go after their character. Like, he was a party guy, or he smoked pot, or, I mean, we hear this all the time.
Yeah, it's actually with, like, police officers and, like, the people that you're trying to tell them that something is wrong.
Yeah, and I mean, even studies have shown that whether it's tribal police, FBI, that's not often the first recourse that Indigenous communities turn to when sort of these things arise. I remember reading a report or a study from a few years ago that kind of showed that, you know, like, there is this mistrust of these federal agencies. And I mean, and it's not just sort of something we're imagining. The Government Accountability Office released a report a few years ago saying, yeah, you know, we've historically failed protecting Indigenous communities, even though we took over the jurisdiction for them, and you know, the jurisdiction is under us. We've kind of historically have failed to protect them.
Today we're joined by Ivy and Ivan McDonald. They are siblings and filmmakers. They're working on a documentary called When They Were Here, which is about the epidemic of missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. And you can watch a clip of the film at yourcallradio.org. If you're in the Bay Area, they are speaking tonight at UC Berkeley and the Multicultural Center at 6 p.m. It's a free event. And if you have any questions or comments for Ivy or Ivan, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Let's hear from James in San Rafael. Hi, James. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I'm glad you're covering this issue. I follow true crime, and I have for quite a while. And there's so many stories of serial killers who prey on women in both Canada and the northern United States. They go back and forth through the Canadian border, which is quite permeable. They go up, it's like happy hunting grounds. Anywhere where there's less police per square mile is where serial killers will go to do their thing. And it's just disgusting that it's gone on with such impunity for so long. And what's happening in northern Montana is very similar to what's happened up in Canada to Native American women up there. But it's just gone on for so long. And it's
at any given time, our reservation, like I had mentioned, is the size of Delaware. And at any given time, there's 7-8 police tops patrolling an area that size. And I've often been told, and something, you know, that might be misunderstood, is that what I had mentioned earlier, you know, I'm not going to call the police and have them wait 4 hours to make it from one end of the reservation to the other. And, you know, that's just what these communities have to deal with.
Can you talk about the difference between how the Canadian government deals with this versus the U.S. government?
I think a big thing is that the Canadian government has, in their own way, has made some strides. I mean, that there's a lot of things that the Canadian government has done for Indigenous communities that the United States government hasn't done. So a few years ago, there was the Truth and Reconciliation on boarding schools and the effects that had on First Nations. They had the MMIW reconciliation report from, I think that came out end of last year, or beginning of last year. And I think that there is some effort, but I think a lot of that effort has been driven by the communities, and it's kind of taken decades. And I mean, the MMIW movement started in Canada 30, 40 years ago, and it's kind of taken this longstanding work to eventually get to that point.
Well, thank you for the call, James. We'll go to another caller in just a minute. What changes would you like to see in the U.S. now that this issue is getting attention? People in Congress are at least giving it some lip service. What changes would you like to see?
I think there needs to be an initial address of how reservation systems are structured and how jurisdiction plays out, where, you know, tribes have jurisdiction over their own tribal members, unless they, you know, so tribes kind of have this jurisdiction and then they have jurisdiction over no one else. That kind of happens, you know, if someone, if a non-tribal member was like to commit a crime on a reservation, it's like, you know, okay, you know, so that's out of our control. We have to wait for the state or the federal police. And that there's a lot of these jurisdictional issues that can exacerbate the crisis of, okay, we find a body on the reservation. Who do we even turn to first to kind of begin the investigation? And I think kind of this idea of, if tribes don't have the power, the resources to accurately prosecute and investigate these crimes that happen, even though they're overly represented, you know, what kind of recourse do we have? The Department of Justice declines to prosecute almost 60%, if I remember the number correctly, 60% of violent crimes that happen on reservations. And so, you know, that there's this disconnect of disproportionate crime happening, but, you know, there's not any way to really address it.
What did you think of Donald Trump signing an executive order last November establishing a federal task force to explore this crisis? And they're announcing a $1.5 million, I guess, it's $1.5 million will be spent to hire missing persons coordinators in U.S. attorneys' offices that handle large caseloads in Arizona, New Mexico, and Oklahoma to establish what they're calling better protocols for handling these cases.
Yes, Operation Lady Justice, as it's nicknamed. I think that there has been a lot of pushback from Indigenous communities, activists, leaders, that, you know, this task force, from my knowledge, doesn't have many tribal leaders. It doesn't have activists. It doesn't have people directly involved with the crisis to accurately address it. You know, there's been this push, I think, in the last maybe 1 to 2 years of really kind of trying to draft MMIW legislation, but it's like, okay, if we don't have an understanding of what's happening, some of this legislation, you know, can harm communities, or it can kind of entrench the powers that be that, you know, turned the blind eye in the first place. It's like, how do we give power to the tribal communities? How do we give power to the people involved with the crisis to, you know, even begin that discussion of how do we address it? We can throw money at the, you know, a big talking point up to this point was like, oh, you know, we need data. And it wasn't until people started collecting their own data. But, you know, the Department of Justice had all the money. You know, there is money to collect the data, but it just wasn't collected.
And I'm just looking at this press release right now about this task force. And you're right. Every single member is a government official.
Yeah.
Yeah. No tribal leaders. Mm-hmm. No people versed in tribal law. Like when I was taught, I was like, okay, you know, you didn't even reach out to Sarah Deer, Rebecca Nagel, a lot of those people who understand the crisis, not just being as Indigenous women, but foundationally, the legal structures of it.
Well, let's go to another caller. Let's hear from Kathleen in San Francisco. Hi, Kathleen. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. Thank you so much, Ivy and Ivan, for the work you're doing. It's so important. I mean, the general public has, as you know, been just really unaware of the situation for so long. You know, we knew about the missing women in Mexico, but I only recently came to know that all of these tribal people were undergoing this issue and also not being addressed by law enforcement. And so it's really good to know this being more understood. And I'm going to ask a question that I've wondered before when people have talked about it too, though. Nobody ever talks about who does these crimes. Like the caller suggested, serial killers. I mean, I'm sure it's some kind of white racist of some kind, but who are the sorts of people that are doing these killings? Is it an organized thing? Do you have any idea? Is there ever any of them that are brought to justice? I have no idea who is it that does this.
Yeah. I think it's kind of just a mix overall. I think that if you think with Indigenous women, you know, I think it's murder is the third, homicide is the third leading cause of death, according to the CCD, or CDC for women 15 to 24. And, you know, I don't know if I think it's necessarily like this organized, you know, effort. I think it's really just sort of understanding that these vulnerable groups, if left unprotected, can happen. I know that there was a lot of, I've often heard and read a lot of like anecdotal firsthand accounts of, particularly in the Navajo Reservation, of people going missing or being murdered there, and the person, you know, the person who committed the crime was like, oh, you can't touch me. I can go outside the border and there's no jurisdiction for me there. And I think that that's a lot of the things of, we have to understand that, you know, sort of the foundational aspect of colonization that kind of created this country was kind of rooted in the sexual violence of Indigenous women and people. Sarah Deer, in her book, The Beginning and End of Rape, has these amazing firsthand accounts of aristocrats who arrived with Columbus during his second conquest, and the firsthand accounts of the violence that they subjected the Carib woman to, that the Carib women were deserving of it because of the way they dressed or because of the dark skin. And I think that's kind of the twofold issue of the crisis, is that you have to address a lot of these historical contexts to even begin to kind of understand that this has been happening for centuries.
What would you add, Ivy?
Yeah, I think, like Ivan said, understanding that this has been going on since colonization, and that because Indigenous women are vulnerable, and you know, and especially on reservations and all of that. And I think too, you know, the caller just said that, talked about Mexico and like all the women going there. And I think people have to understand that it's not just in the United States. It's where any Indigenous, you know, Canada, South America, United States. And so I think that, and even in Canada, there's a highway they call the Highway of Tears, which is a 65-mile stretch of highway where a lot of Indigenous women have been found murdered or have gone missing on that highway. And
there was a book that just came out about it.
Yeah. And so it's sort of like understanding that of being, you know, this happens everywhere. And yeah.
Given that this issue is getting so much more attention, I mean, we talked about the changes that you'd like to see, Ivan. Are there any changes you'd like to add to that, Ivy? I mean, we, you know, there's these bills, for example, the Not Invisible Act introduced by Deb Haaland and Charisse Davids, the two Native women in the House, this task force, you know. But what, like, major changes would you like to see?
I think being able to sit down and work with Indigenous people who are firsthand dealing with this. I think, you know, like, you could have experts, you can have whatever you want, but it's the families who are the people going through this and have been going through this. And I think getting to the understanding of, like, if you want to pass a bill or something like that, or if you want to do legislation, I think you have to not just do it in this colonized way of, because it's not working, obviously. And I think going back and, like, really structuring it in a cohesive manner of talking to families, talking to that, and then realizing, like, okay, well, let's implement what we've learned from indigenous people, and then move it into this bigger spectrum of, like, legislation and stuff like that.
And I'm so glad. I was so glad when I heard about the film, because nowadays documentaries, they're so powerful. And once this comes out, a lot of people are going to be made aware of this in a different light, I'm sure, and then so many more conversations are going to be had. What's the status of the film?
Yeah, so the film is currently, I think we're kind of just leaving our research and development. Hopefully we'll be in production sometime soon. So yeah, that's just what we are. We've done some initial shoots. We just recently got some very great support from people involved in the documentary filmmaking world, and we're just kind of pushing forward. We're raising money. Surprisingly, we've gotten a lot of personal, like, bigger personal donations from people who have just kind of bared witness to our work, and you know, that's just kind of the way that they know how to help us, and, you know, hopefully get us to the point where the film is completed. But yeah, we are currently in production. If you would like to sort of follow the progress, you can follow us on Facebook at When They Were Here. Our website is www.whentheywerehere.com, and on Instagram, it's When They Were Here as well.
Well, we'd love to have you back when the film comes out. Thank you so much for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you. Ivan and Ivy McDonald are siblings and filmmakers. Their new documentary in progress is called When They Were Here. And if you're in the Bay Area, they'll be at UC Berkeley tonight at the Multicultural Center, 6 o'clock. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.